Welcome to this Forthright Radio for March 18th, 2020. I'm Joy LeClaire. We have a very full show for you today. With us for the full hour is Betsy Gaines Quammen, whose book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God, and Public Lands in the West, has just been published by Torrey House Press. Torrey House Press, Voices for the Land, is an independent, nonprofit publisher promoting environmental conservation through literature. Betsy Gaines Quammen is an historian and conservationist. She received a doctorate in environmental history from Montana State University in 2017. Her dissertation focused on Mormon settlement and public lands conflicts. She has studied various religious traditions over the years, with particular attention to how cultures view landscapes and wildlife. The rural American West, pastoral communities of northern Mongolia, and the grasslands of East Africa have been her main areas of interest. As part of her doctoral research, she began interviewing the Bundy family and others in 2015. Betsy Gaines Quammen, welcome to Forthright Radio. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Betsy, your book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West, just published by Torrey House Press, couldn't come out at a better time. It's been many years in the making. It grew out of your doctoral research. How many years is that? And just what was your doctorate in environmental history on?
Well, that's a good question. I have probably been working on this for about 7 years. And it started because I was fascinated with how religions viewed landscapes. And I worked for a number of years in Mongolia working with Buddhist monks. And the way that they saw rivers, wildlife, and land was very much conservation oriented. There was a feeling of sentience in nature, and therefore it was treated with utmost respect. And I came back to the United States and initially was thinking about pursuing my dissertation research in Mongolia, but I couldn't read Mongolian. And so I thought it would take me a couple of years to get proficient enough to read primary texts and didn't want to take all that time. So I got to looking at how religion manifested itself on the American landscape. And in the West in particular, I looked at the idea of Zion National Park, which was the first national park in Utah, and was fascinated by this idea that a national park could be named after Mormon homeland, Zion, and began to get very interested in this history and story there, and to try to understand how Mormon culture perceived landscape. And at that point, I knew very little about Mormonism. And so I started my research, and 7 years later, it became a book.
Well, we've done numerous shows over the years relating to the Bundy family stories, as well as the problems of grazing permits on public lands. We'll link to our interviews with Christopher Ketchum about his book, This Land, How Cowboys, Capitalism, and Corruption Are Ruining the American West, and also our recent interview with Catherine Stewart about her book, The Power Worshippers, Inside the Dangerous Rise of Religious Nationalism. And your book, Betsy, is American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West. And in some ways, it's a synthesis of both of these approaches. Let's begin with a sort of origin story for what became the Church of Jesus Christ Latter-day Saints, because as you document, it is important in understanding the motivations and viewpoints of people like Cliven Bundy. Joseph Smith was born in 1805, not long after the ratification of the U.S. Constitution. How did this man set into motion the situations you document in American Zion?
It's a very interesting story. Joseph Smith, who grew up in the Burnt Over District, it was full of religious fervor. It was a place where a number of religious leaders, prophets, second comings were operating in these kind of revival-like environments. And it was called the Burned Over District because it was burned over with religious zeal. And so this is where Joseph Smith grew up. And the story goes that he couldn't find a person or a version of religion that seemed right for him. So he was visited by an angel, and the angel told him where he could dig up golden plates, and he did. And from the inscriptions on the golden plates, he translated them, and it became the Book of Mormon. The Book of Mormon was one of the religious texts, but during his lifetime, he generated voluminous prophecies and revelations. And there are a couple that are very important to the Bundy story. The first was the promise of Mormon homeland, Zion, that the Mormon people would have their own land, that they would await the second coming of Christ. It was a sacred promise from God. And the first place Zion was meant to be was Missouri. And when the Mormons tried to settle in Missouri, they faced a great deal of religious oppression and were run out of Missouri in a heartbreaking way. And then they went to Illinois and were in a place called Nauvoo. And by this time, Joseph Smith was very, very aware that his religion was under siege, that he felt like he needed to protect his people and his faith. And he built an army that was the second largest army next to the American army. And so at this point, you have two things that are very important to Mormon ideology. Number one, you have the idea of homeland, that you deserve it. And number two, it becomes a militant theology that you have to have military might to protect what is yours. And the third thing that happened within this time period was probably an apocryphal prophecy that came about after Joseph Smith died, but is no less important to people who believe it. And this was called the White Horse Prophecy, that talked about how when the Constitution was hanging by the thread, it would take Mormons to protect it. And so the Bundys really believe that we're at the moment of having the Constitution hanging by a thread, and that it's up to them to protect all of us as we the people. So the other piece of that is that the Constitution became somewhat of a sacred document as well. So you have these layers, or these chapters rather, in Mormon history that the Bundys use to build their case for what they're doing.
Among the many things I learned in your book, American Zion, is that Joseph Smith was actually mining. He was seeking treasure or something. But anyway, the idea is he was mining when he found these golden tablets. And it seems to me, in terms of how the story develops and how public lands or land in general should be used, that there was a high priority or value placed on resource extraction from the very, very beginning of this story. Do you agree with that? Do you think there's something to that?
I like the direction you're thinking. Mining in particular is a complicated one with the Mormon church, because Joseph Smith started out as a treasure seeker. So he was digging to acquire Spanish silver or the treasure of the conquistadors or ancient native riches, but he never found anything until he found what he said were golden plates. And that idea of mining, he abandoned mining. He became a prophet. And when they finally did, the Mormon people, by then Joseph Smith had been assassinated, and the Mormon people finally did establish Zion in Utah, parts of Nevada, parts of Arizona, and Idaho. And Zion became this very special sacred homeland. And so when other people started coming into this Mormon empire, initially they were really resented, and they were the miners. And so Brigham Young said, I hope that God hides up all the treasure from us, because he saw the mining culture is very corrupting. There was alcohol, there was prostitution, there were shady deals that were happening. And this would have been happening right around Park City, but it also was at other mines throughout Utah. And so they were reticent to deal with the mining culture. However, there was one mining claim that Brigham Young thought he did want to pursue, and that was in Nevada. And that became complicated and resulted in a Mormon man who had staked the claim being murdered. But mining, the early church looked at it as a primrose path. But what they didn't look at as corrupting was grazing and ranching. And both of those were seen as wholesome. There was an idea that by working the land, they could return it to the Garden of Eden. They didn't value natural landscapes, ones that were wild without the imprint of humanity. They wanted land that was developed. And I think at that time, ranching was seen as something that was a pleasing activity to God.
Well, we have to remember at that time, the area that is now the state of Utah, Nevada, Arizona, was not part of the United States. It wasn't even a territory. In fact, it had only recently been won by conquest from the Spanish Empire. So that's part of that setting. The early pioneers into Utah in that area, they really saw themselves as setting up, as you call it, an empire, regardless of the fact, mythologically, it was this empty land, right? But was it so empty, Betsy Gaines Quammen?
I love that you're bringing all these issues together, because I think that this landscape is multi-layered. And so you're talking about when the Mormons came into the Great Basin, Brigham Young had been very happy to bring them there because it belonged to Mexico. And at that point, he was really furious with the United States. He didn't think that they'd been protected, given a fair shake, that they were being pushed out. They weren't able to establish themselves. And so they made this long trip to Utah and wanted to be out of the country that they felt hated them and they hated in return. And so they went to this area. Within a year, the Treaty of Hidalgo was signed, and it became the United States again. So they once again were back in the country of who they perceived their enemies. But it was a country other white settlers had not decided to settle in. It was a difficult country. It was not easy to establish homesteads and farms. It was arid. It was a hard place to settle. And yet there were a number of tribes that were living there that were doing quite well with the land. And they thought it was their sacred territory as well. So you had a group of people coming in and saying, oh, we're finally establishing our sacred homeland. And then you had indigenous nations that were saying, we beg to differ. This is our sacred landscape. So we do have this very, very layered cultural landscape with different understandings.
So we're talking about 1846 and 7. And let's not understate what the experience of persecution among the Mormons was. I mean, a lot of them were killed in vigilante style activities. They fled from place to place in the winter of 1846, 1847. 1,200 families walked 1,300 miles from the winter quarters in Nebraska. Hundreds of them died of starvation and other illnesses on the way. So they arrive there in Utah, and they think they're going to be their land. Bingo, the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo happens. All of a sudden, here's their enemy, the U.S. again. You do a good job, Betsy, of explaining what they saw their situation as. Anyone who's been to Utah, it's not like the East Coast. It's not a particularly moderate climate. It's beautiful, but it's not that moderate. And opting for ranching and farming was really challenging. And it's impressive that they were able to make livings there as quickly as they did. So let's grant them that. However, it gets pretty ugly pretty fast, but we cannot gloss over the mountain meadows incident because it also involves the Southern Paiutes, who were one of the indigenous nations there, at least in the mythology. Briefly talk about that, please.
The Mormon people had been in the Great Basin region, Colorado Plateau area, for about 10 years when Americans, they were upset about two different issues, slavery and polygamy. And there was pressure being put on the Buchanan administration to do something about the Mormons because it would maybe get people's attention away from the slavery issue because there were many people who wanted to protect the whole institution of slavery. And so they were trying to have a diversion. And so he sent troops to Utah in 1857, and they whipped the Mormon people up. They were, once again, they were being persecuted by the American government. They were furious. There was a lot of just complete, just seething anger and resentment over this. And by this time, they had had this huge army, the Nauvoo Legion, which, as I had said earlier, was the second largest military body in the country. And they started to get prepared for war. And this happened right at the time when there were wagon trains going through Utah on their way to California, and it was a major thoroughfare. So there were people coming through with some frequency and would often stop, and they might restock, or they might get some food or water their livestock. And Brigham Young started to say, "We will not protect them from Native American raids," when at the same time he was whipping up the contacts that they had, the network of Native allies and those that he had relationships with, encouraging them to attack Americans who were moving through the state. And one of the parties was a party called the Baker-Fancher Party, and they happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And the Mormon people painted their faces dark. They did engage some Southern Paiute in this particular attack, and they attacked a wagon train, killing over 120 people. One of the participants was Nephi Johnson, who is Clive and Bundy's great-grandfather.
Let's move ahead now. You go into a lot of very interesting stories of what's happening in the intervening time. Exploration is starting to go on. John Wesley Powell's very famous expeditions through the area, the exploring the western lands, the Grand Canyon, all of that sort of thing. Meanwhile, the Mormons are settling in all over the Great Basin. They're making homesteads and orchards and farms. And then this movement begins of protecting the natural environment with the first national park in the world, Yellowstone, under Ulysses S. Grant in 1872. That wasn't in their backyard so much. That was a bit to the north. Unfold how the public lands began to be established in the Intermountain West and the relationship that the Mormons began to feel about that.
What you had, the Mormons were settling what they at this point felt was finally their Zion, their homeland. This was finally a place where they were safe from persecution and where they could practice their religion. And they were so incredibly determined to protect their land that they killed a number of these families that were moving across what they saw as their place. And about 10 years after that, we started to see the United States have an interest in understanding what these places on the maps that hadn't been homesteaded, or there weren't people living in these places that were essentially public domain, big spaces that didn't have permanent settlements on them. And John Wesley Powell was one of the people who went out to start looking, surveying essentially these areas, and with an eye towards water sources and how the government was going to deal with these lands. What were they going to become? And there were a couple of members of his expedition, they were sort of under the influence of Emerson, that they didn't see the lands as, oh, how can we use them, but as extensions of God's handiwork. These are beautiful places. And how is it that we're going to begin to protect them, which was somewhat of a newer idea, this idea of conservation. And so when people were starting to hear about the places in Utah and how extraordinarily beautiful they are, there was a different way of seeing landscape than the Mormons had seen it, which was utilitarian. And so as people came out and began to think about the idea of national parks, especially in Zion, it was really collaborative, because this was at a time where the Mormon people were needing to think of diversifying their revenue. And the idea of tourism was brand new, and the trains were interested in getting passengers out there. So everybody wanted to figure out a way to get tourism to. And so national parks became an idea of getting people out there, spending money and job creation. And at that point, the local culture was gung-ho. And so Zion, even though when Zion National Park was established, and there were definitely people using it for sheep, for pigs, it was being used by farmers and ranchers, and they were pushed out of the canyon. But there wasn't a lot of animosity about it. I think people were really excited to have their homeland be on the American map. And it was almost a type of reconciliation after so many years of violence and anger, that this was going to be a place where people came to admire it. With the establishment of Zion National Park, it is very much an anomaly, because local people were on board, even though it did come with restrictions. They were no longer allowed to have livestock in Zion Canyon. At the time, there were still some families living there that were able to go on and live there until the 30s. But it was a joyful time. There was not the resentment that we would see over the next decade.
Well, let's talk about that, how the resentment, which became increasingly fierce, began and developed.
Let's see. It started immediately after Zion National Park, because the Park Service was very gung-ho. But the Park Service was created in 1916, and they began to explore other places that they wanted to establish parks in Utah. And so there were issues with Cedar Breaks. Cedar Breaks had a big timber stand there, and local people wanted to make it a tourist place but reserve the right to log the area. Bryce Canyon had people grazing in it. There were cows in Bryce Canyon, and so they didn't want to have restrictions with their grazing operations. So they made an agreement with the Park Service to grandfather in and have the cows slowly be removed over a period of years. But the local people did not like the idea of having these big landscapes have so many restrictions involved with them in turning them or in designating them national parks. But maybe the first time I saw real anger was over the discussion, and this I believe was in 1936, over the discussion of making Escalante a national park or national monument. But it was a hearing that was held in Price, Utah, where you heard one man say, "You're coming in here to the national park people, and you want to put a big circle around this place that where we graze our cows, and you want to run us out of business. Your position is not one that's a moral one. You all are not being moral in looking at protecting land." And I thought that was really interesting, because I think that that has continued, that ranchers today in this region see the idea of large landscape conservation as being immoral.
Let's dig into that a little bit more, because it really does get to the crux of the issue. The way we have discussed these things in past shows is economic, the capitalism aspect of it and the private property and that kind of thing. But one of the amazing things in your study, Betsy Gang Quammens, is that actually this is a spiritual and a religious issue for many of these people. Please go into that a bit more.
It is different, because I've met with ranchers up in Montana, and there's a difference between talking to livestock producers who run cows on public lands in Nevada and Utah than those up in Montana. You hear the story from a lot of ranchers. My grandfather ranched this land. My great-grandfather ranched this land. But the story with the Mormon people, you even hear more so because it's one of adversary. So they were able to get out of this terrible situation. They finally came to this land where no other white people wanted to settle. And they took the land from native people who had been doing just fine there. But they took over the best water sources and the best bits. Because God had promised them this land, by God, they were going to claim it and they were not going to budge. And so when the government started coming in and wanting to create these conservation spaces, these national parks and national monuments, it really flew in the face of what the Mormon people saw. To the Mormon people, landscapes shouldn't be protected as is. Sacred landscapes are built. They're ones that come about through human ingenuity. Whereas the people who were coming in, and again, they had their own spiritual rubric that they were looking at the land. A lot of the early preservationists, like John Muir, were very much influenced by Emerson, who celebrated land as unbuilt, as sacred space, just in the way it is. So these cultures were really butting heads. But in addition to that, the Mormons felt like no one should tell them what to do on their own lands. And they were very resistant to any sort of regulations. And so we began to see, not too long after the establishment of Zion, each new government regulation or new government idea in terms of land protection sowed these seeds of deep anger.
It gets back to the question of the ownership of the land. Who owns it? And as you have shown in your book, American Zion, many of the Mormons believe that the U.S. Constitution is a sacred document. You even quote Cliven Bundy as believing that Jesus wrote the, or at least inspired, the U.S. Constitution. If you can answer this question, at the time that these things were happening, did the government own this land, or was it unclaimed and then the U.S. government took it and claimed it? How did that work?
It was public domain, so it belonged to the government. Under the Homestead Act, people could make a claim and have a homestead. But those that were not homesteaded, this land was somewhat of a commons, and everybody ran their cows all through there. And so the government realized that they had a real problem because people were running way too many cows. The areas were getting completely eroded and destroyed, and the vegetation was changing. Before the Taylor Grazing Act, there was a really bad problem with overgrazing in the United States. So the government wanted to sort out how to best manage the land. That's when we had the Taylor Grazing Act, and out of that came the early grazing agency that later became the Bureau of Land Management. And so there was this impression that the Mormons had, this was all Mormon land because they'd been the ones who used it as a commons, but it really was under federal control.
Okay, and so the Taylor Grazing Act was in 1934, and that was the act that established the process for 10-year leases on the land, and also what was called animal units, which meant cow-calf pairs, and it established the grazing service in the Bureau of Land Management. Let's fast forward. There's a lot that you cover in the book that we won't be able to get to, but what really set things to a boil were the series of environmental acts that happened in the 60s and the 70s. Talk about those.
The American citizens really did want to become better conservationists. The Silent Spring, Rachel Carson's book, really created an awareness about what was happening in the United States. And this was actually a bipartisan effort to start to look at laws, conservation laws that would protect land and waters and species. So we had the Endangered Species Act, we had NEPA, which is the National Environmental Policy Act, and FLIPMA, which was the Federal Land Policy Management Act. And these laws began to create regulations for use on public land. And they started to feel like they were restricting the authority that the Mormon ranchers, or ranchers all through the United States, really felt entitled to making their own rules. Initially, after the Taylor Grazing Act, it was ranchers who were overseeing management, and they were the ones making decisions. Now there were regulations that were going to determine how many cow-calf pairs they could have, what seasons they were able to graze, what animals were being protected. Endangered Species Act started to really restrict certain activities around animals that were endangered. NEPA called for a real oversight on various activities as well. And FLIPMA began to prompt the BLM to do inventories of their areas to begin to look at what qualified as wilderness areas, which was tremendously controversial.
Yes, and it ended the Homestead Act, which was also the end of an era for sure. All right, so out of this melee of environmental protection activism comes counteractivism in the form of the Sagebrush Rebellion. Talk about that situation too.
Well, the Sagebrush Rebellion did come about after these environmental laws were passed, and it came out of Nevada. There was a real movement to have states be able to control what was happening on the lands. Even though they were federal lands, the state wanted more control, and it became a real cowboy movement. It was, don't tread on me. You can't tell us what to do. These are our states. And we saw little dust ups, guns started getting involved. There was one in Utah that was notable in a place that's now called Grandstaff Canyon, where they were doing a survey looking at large areas that didn't have roads. And the locals in Grand County kept pushing a bulldozer into the area so that they kept establishing a road. And there was just a lot of back and forth between agents and local people. And things were starting to get, there was the feeling that there could potentially be violence.
For example, in 1976, Robert Redford's image was burnt in effigy because he was seen as leading an anti-coal plant that some people wanted to come through. There were rumors that the Bureau of Land Management was weaponizing, and as you said, the illegal road building. Some of the people who started the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, they also got a lot of threats. In fact, Robert Weed Wynick, his family was more than threatened. Nails were placed in such a way that caused his wife and children driving in a car to have a blowout that could have been fatal. Fortunately, it wasn't. Their well was contaminated. That was in 1984. So things were really heating up. And then the Reagan administration came in. And James Watt was the Department of Interior director, the secretary. And then, I'll remind our listeners, things really heated up by the end of the 80s and into the 90s. In terms of, this is not just ranchers that we're talking about now, but the whole militia movement. Things like the Ruby Ridge standoff in which people were killed. Will you take it from there? I'm sure you can see where I'm trying to send us.
I think that what was happening, as you know, when we had the Sagebrush Rebellion to begin with, the Reagan administration did come in and everybody settled down because they felt like the Reagan administration had their back. James Watt did have their back. He did some awful things in terms of conservation policy. And yes, there were threats going around. Burning in effigies happened with some regularity, but things did calm down a little bit. And then when we got Clinton into office, all of a sudden there was a shift, and there were Westerners who felt once again that everything they counted on was at stake. And so we started to see a new kind of the Sagebrush Rebellion became what's known as the wise use movement. And instead of focusing on, I don't know, that, you know, getting the lands back in the hands of the state, it was more, how can we frame it so that the U.S. citizens really feel for us and our plight? And that's when it was, oh, environmentalists want to choose spotted owls over jobs. And, you know, this is about feeding my family. And we're the real working people of the world. We're the cowboys. And it just became this more compelling way of framing these issues that had been going on, but they were now getting a little more savvy. And we also had this really anti-government backlash over the Ruby Ridge incident, where Randy Weaver's wife was killed, son was killed, and they were holed up for a while they were surrounded by FBI. And that became this huge rallying cry for militia, and also to many people, evidence that the government was evil. And right after that, we had the Branch Davidians and the terrible fire at their compound. Again, the government was blamed for being overbearing and violent and killing innocent people. And there was this movement where people felt like, gosh, in order to protect ourselves, we need to start organizing and having guns. And then at first it was at conferences and country fairs and maybe gun shows, people were having these conversations. And then with the advent of the internet, all of a sudden these networks became more and more organized and more conversant. So you had these larger militia circles that were proliferating throughout the West.
And then meanwhile, let's back up, because there's a whole nother element that we haven't even begun talking about here. And that is the role of prophecy and the belief that we're in an end time. You talk about an individual named Willard Cleon Skousen, his role in this. We only have a little bit of time left, so we won't be able to devote very much time to it, but it's really crucial to understanding the motivations of people like Cliven Bundy and his family, and their sense of righteousness in the face of what many of us find perplexing. So please speak about the role of prophecy and the concept that we're in an end times and how it relates to these things.
Well, as I explained earlier in the interview, there were things that came out of the early church that have been used by the Bundys to legitimate what they're doing. And one of those was this idea of the white horse prophecy, which, again, the Mormons at some point are going to be in charge of protecting our Constitution. As you said, the other idea that came out of this kind of early Joseph Smith chapter is the idea of latter times. These are latter day saints. And so that idea is always around the corner that we're going to see end times. And so this has been conflated, this idea of protecting the Constitution and ushering in the second coming. This is something that has kind of been rolled together. And Cleon Skousen was a very interesting character. He was in the FBI for a while. He was part of the Salt Lake City police force. He taught at BYU. He wrote voluminous, just many, many, many books. But one of the books that he talked about, it's called Modern Prophecy, where he is looking at the Bible, looking at the Book of Mormon, looking at, you know, sacred texts and using them literally. So he's talking about things that we need to get prepared for. And Cleon Skousen has become very instrumental to the Bundys because he did have some of these ideas that the federal government cannot own public land, that Mormons have to be the ones who protect the Constitution, that Mormons understand the Constitution better than non-Mormons. And he and some prophets that he was friends with, some of the higher Mormon prophets or the heads of the church, actually started to see that this would be a time of violence, that when this happened, it would require, it wasn't going to be easy. It wasn't going to be something that we could just, or the Mormon people could just pray away. This was going to be a time of real action.
And these people believe that God speaks to them. And that is in a literal way that they're getting direct communication from God. Do I have that right?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, this also goes back to early church. Joseph Smith at one point made it a point that he was the only one who could verify if the prophecy was right or not. And John Krakauer writes about this in Under the Banner of Heaven, that he at one point tried to say, everybody can talk to God. It's, you know, and then all of a sudden he thought, oh gosh, you know, I'm going to be having people contradicting me and this could be a problem. And so he tried to put the kibosh on it. But there has always been an idea in Mormonism that the prophet could hear directly from God. So when Joseph Smith died, Brigham Young started to hear from God, and then it went down with each prophet who was the president of the church could correspond directly with God. But there was still this idea in Mormon circles that God could speak to whoever he spoke to. So with Dan and Ron Lafferty, who Under the Banner of Heaven is about, they heard God telling them to kill their sister-in-law and her baby and a couple of other people. And that was direct prophecy from God. With the Bundys, Ammon is hearing directly from God. God is telling him, God told him to go to Oregon to protect the Hammonds, to make sure that they weren't arrested, and then to go on to the Malheur Wildlife Refuge and take it over. He prays and he gets direct messages from God. So this is something that has its roots in the early church. It's not condoned by the main Mormon church, but yes, this is prophecy. Their actions are based on prophecy.
We are not going to be able to go into the very interesting documentation you do of the Bunkerville incident and then the Malheur Bird Refuge incidents. Listeners will simply have to get your book, American Zion, for that. But we are now in a situation where the Department of Interior, the Bureau of Land Management, among other agencies of the United States government, have pretty much been taken over by people who believe that public lands should not be held by the federal government. They should be given back to the states. I wonder if you have comments on that.
Yeah, it's terrible. Current head of the BLM believes that the government shouldn't own land. He wrote a book called Sagebrush Rebels. He's a huge fan of this movement. And he runs the BLM, which is 260 million acres of federal land. And he also believes in deregulation. We're seeing these calls to mine, drill, and increase livestock numbers on our national monuments. It's terrible. And not only that, William Perry Penley is a big constitutional sheriff advocate, which means just like the Bundys, he thinks county sheriffs can have higher authority than law enforcement. And so if the county sheriffs don't like a gun regulation, they don't have to enforce it in their area. And if the sheriff doesn't think that the cows or the Bundys are violating any laws, that they're running cows, then they can enforce that. And that's what's happening right now in a little place called Monroe Mountain in Utah. There's a man named Stanton Gleaves, whose second cousin is the sheriff, and this rancher, Stanton Gleaves, is breaking laws. He's trespassing. He's overstocking his allotments, and he's not following federal rules. And the family member who occupies the sheriff's position has basically said, if anybody comes and tries to enforce this, they're going to have to talk to me. I mean, it's a threat. And so we have the head of the BLM saying, oh, I really like that movement. I mean, it's absolutely dangerous and lawless, just lawless.
Yes, except that they say that they have a higher moral sense than the majority of the people who support federal ownership of public lands, in effect, the communal ownership of public lands by the American citizens. Betsy Gaines Quammen, I'm so sorry, we're just about out of time. I want to give you the last minute to share with listeners the most particular thing that we did not get to in our interview today.
Well, I feel like this has been a great and wide-ranging interview. The book is really about the religious origins of the Bundy family. And as you were saying, they have a very specific way of talking about we the people. This is something that they bring up over and over and over again. And in saying that, they disregard what most of us believe, which is protecting public lands. Right now, they are absolutely so at stake. They're really, really, really vulnerable right now. And it's up to all of us to shout at the top of our lungs to take care of these lands. The way that the Bundys want to manage them, it's not viable for the long term. I mean, they're going to be overgrazed. Wildlife, so much wildlife is killed every year to make these public lands pasture lands. They're not pasture lands. They're the lands that we hike on and that we bike on and that we enjoy and that give us solace when we need to be in the middle of nature. And they're absolutely imperiled right now. And the Bundys are so certain that they're right. Number one, because God's telling them that, they say. And number two, they're getting away with it. They have gotten away with a takeover. They've gotten away with an armed standoff. And they are more empowered than they've ever been. And so my book is really about how this has happened and what's at stake. And it's also a call to all of us to do what we can to protect these precious places.
Betsy Gaines Quammen, thank you so much for joining us today on Forthright Radio. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. This was a pleasure. I'm very glad to have the opportunity, Joy.
If I can fit it in, what do you want to say in terms of connecting this to the current COVID-19?
I don't know if it quite fits, but I it is kind of funny because one of the things I talk about in the book is this anti-scientism. There's so much. I mean, no matter what the data says, the Bundys are going to, they're just going to disregard it. And so when I've been looking at what their response is to the COVID-19 outbreak, they are saying it's a hoax. Everybody's, the media's overblowing it. They're putting up memes of toilet paper bunkers. You know, this isn't going to protect you. And I guess what I was going to say is another one of the dangers of people in those, these communities, they have this anti-government, anti-science bubble, and they are so connected, and they're going back and forth with their jokes about COVID, their jokes about science, their jokes about liberals. These are the people who are not only dangerous in terms of, you know, sedition and armed takeovers, but they're also really dangerous in this proliferation of misinformation. And right now we have something unbelievably dangerous happening, and these guys are making it a joke. And it's not surprising because this is their culture, this anti-government, anti-science culture. But it just is one more thing to prove that these pockets are dangerous to all of us.
You quote Edmund Bundy in your book, American Zion, as saying, "Science is the religion of heretics." And I would just add that your husband is David Quammen, and his book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic, almost seems a bit prophetic as well, but in a science way, not in a religious way.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, right now, David is constantly on the phone with people all over the world, press all over the world, talking about what he predicted in his book Spillover, which was a coronavirus will spill out of a wet market in China. It's just a matter of time. And so he would laugh and say, well, that's what scientists were telling me, not that I predicted it myself. I mean, he's very humble that way. But it really is interesting. And David and I have talked about this a lot. When a religious entity looks at science as evil, the problems that that causes, and it's a very American phenomenon. It's something that we've seen in our country, as evidenced with the Scopes Monkey trial. There are pockets of anti-scientism here, and when we're in the middle of a pandemic, that's going to be a problem.
Well, I could go on for a very long time talking with you. I enjoy it so much, but we're going to have to leave it there. Again, Betsy Gaines Quammen, thank you so much.
Thank you. And anytime you want to talk, I'm happy to do it.
Okay. Well, I might take you up on that. Be careful. And I will also link with the interview that David gave us in, I don't know, 2014 or whenever that came out. It is by far one of the most listened to of the interviews in my archive, with good reason.
You have just heard an interview with Betsy Gaines Quammen, Ph.D., about her book, American Zion, Cliven Bundy, God and Public Lands in the West, just published by Tory House Press. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z, Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. I'm Joy LaClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. Recent headlines, including the term shelter in place, reminded us of the poem by Dan Roberts, Helter Shelter. He has graciously allowed us to include it in this broadcast. And since we're on the avenue of poetry, my favorite haiku, written by Kabeyoshi Issa, born in 1763, is pertinent not only because it's one of those poems which is eternally on point, but because in his recent press conference on the White House lawn, President Trump was framed in the video coverage by what the Japanese called sakura, and we call cherry blossoms. In These Latter Day, a poem by Kobayashi Issa, translated by R.H. Blythe. In these latter day degenerate times, cherry blossoms everywhere. Till next time, this is Joy LaClaire, signing out for now.
Helter Shelter. Shelter in place. We hunker down. We grasp flashlight, cell phone, microwave. We shelter in place. We trace a space, duck and cover in the name of the face, the race, and the holy place. We shelter in place. We fall in to the fallout shelter of place. We do not evolve. We do not go past the thread of what has passed. We shelter in place. We drove it till it dropped. We try to get a jump start in the heart. We thicken the pace without a trace. We shelter in place. Shelter in space, the place of silence between two words, the black screen between frames of light, the unmappable border between chaos and order. Shelter in spaced out confusion, an illusion of protection from infection of spirit. Shelter in grace, we embrace the light that makes the truth visible. We erase the false face and replace wall with doorway. We step through with sight, remain in light. We shelter in grace.